Which Way LA is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.
On Dr. King's Holiday, Ethnic Studies in Arizona. Hello again, I'm Marvin Olney, and this is Which Way LA, KCRW's ongoing series on the issues Southern Californians care about. African American studies are alive and well in the high schools of Tucson, but the state attorney general has declared Mexican American studies illegal under a recent law. One piece of evidence, a textbook written long ago by a respected veteran professor at Cal State Northridge. Does teaching that part of the U.S. once belonged to Mexico mean advocating new borders? Does teaching the history of discrimination mean advocating resentment and racism in reverse? Also tonight, Silicon Valley's Computer Museum. Later on, the U.S. and China face-to-face at the White House. First, here's the news. We're in Olney back with Which Way LA on KCRW. As President Hu Jintao arrives tomorrow for a White House visit, the U.S. and China are being compared to two aircraft carriers that can only be moved from the very top. Later, we'll hear how both countries have been preparing and whether personal connections between the heads of state can resolve the increased tensions of recent years. First, a California professor and ethnic studies in Arizona. Dr. Rudy Acuna founded the Chicano Studies Department at Cal State Northridge. At 78, he still teaches in what's become the largest program of its kind in the nation. In 1972, he wrote a book called Occupied America, A History of Chicanos. That book has now been cited as an example of what's wrong with Mexican-American studies in Tucson, Arizona, which have been declared illegal by the state's newly elected Attorney General Tom Horn, former superintendent of schools. We'll talk with Professor Acuna in a moment, but first here's Hector Tobar, columnist for the LA Times. Good as always to have you on our program.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
You went to Arizona. You wrote about this controversy. Give us the background.
The background is that several years ago, there was an incident in which students at a Tucson high school turned their back on an Arizona state official. And not long after that, Tom Horn, who was then the chief state officer in charge of the public schools, wrote an open letter to the people of Tucson, Arizona, saying why he thought Tucson's ethnic studies program in the public schools should be closed. And eventually this led to the passage of House Bill 2281 in Arizona, which was passed on May 20th, 2010, and which took effect on January 1st of this year. And that law made it essentially illegal to teach a course in the state of Arizona public schools that did one of four things: that promoted the overthrow of the U.S. government, that promoted resentment toward a race or class of people, that were designed for students of a particular ethnic group, or that advocated ethnic solidarity instead of the treatment of pupils as individuals. Horn, one of his last acts was that he found that the Tucson program violated those provisions.
One of his last acts as superintendent of public instruction. Now he's attorney general.
That's correct, yes. It was one of his last acts as the superintendent of public instruction.
What is it about the book, which you only read recently, I gathered, that might lead somebody to think that it had violated any of those four provisions?
Well, it's a book that basically recounts the history of Mexican Americans in the U.S. and goes back to actually to the Spanish conquest before that, and it contains episodes of oppression, of injustice, of the breaking of strikes, the lynching of Mexican Americans in Arizona in incidents in the late 19th century and early 20th century, and those are incidents which according to Horn were used to sort of whip up ethnic hatred. But as I point out in my column, it's almost impossible. It would be impossible to teach American history without bringing at least some ethnic resentment into the classroom, because how else could you teach, for example, about slavery or the Japanese internment? You have to feel at least a fleeting sense of outrage when you teach those subjects.
Hector Tobar again, a columnist of the Los Angeles Times. We're now joined by Professor Rudy Acuna. He's founder, once again, of the Chicano Studies Department at Cal State Northridge, the largest of its kind in the nation, and author of Occupied America, A History of Chicanos, which he wrote and which was published in 1972. Professor, it's always good to have you on our program.
Oh, thank you. I haven't heard from you for a long time.
No, it has been a long time, and it's good to have you back. Did you, in that book, were you promoting the overthrow of the United States government?
No, I'm not crazy.
Were you suggesting that because parts of the Southwest, including parts of California, were part of Mexico, they ought to be returned to Mexico?
No, I made it very clear that we didn't. In interviews, I made it very clear that right now the Mexican government is in a mess. Why would someone want to return to Mexico, return the land to Mexico? I think that Mexican Americans, as Latinos, our mission is to make life here in the United States better, more equitable.
What about the third provision that what's prohibited in Arizona is any promotion of resentment toward a race of people?
Well, this one's only directed at La Raza Studies because they've exempted African Americans, and they've exempted Asian Americans, and they've exempted the Asian American. It is a bill that is directly targeting the Mexican American, and this is because group is already a third of the state.
What about the fourth requirement that you not advocate ethnic solidarity as opposed to individuality?
Well, you can talk about anyone when you when you're talking about that. You can talk about African Americans. When Martin Luther King said that, he said as a people they would reach the promised land. And I think that he was talking figuratively, and I do think that that you do have a right to try to get your own group more educated, to get them through college, et cetera. When I got to Cal State Northridge, there were only 50 people of Mexican extraction on campus. Today, there are about 10,000 Latinos. They didn't get there because of the goodwill of the administration.
How did they get there, and did it involve agitation? Did it involve, I guess I should say, disruptions?
I don't know about disruptions, but it did take a pressuring of the administration.
So why do you think this has happened in Arizona? Why is your book part of the focus of this overturning of Mexican-American studies there?
Very simply, it's an issue just like Pete Wilson did in California with Proposition 187. It's an issue that that has no political liability, or they think that there's no political liability, and it's an issue that you can take cheap shots at people. In 2006, the Republican Party was a fairly moderate party. Republican Party was very good on immigration, but they used it to solidify the right, and today the Republican Party is in the hands of your right-wing elements.
Professor Rudy Acuna at Cal State Northridge. Hector Tobar, back to you, columnist at the Los Angeles Times. In the column that you wrote about this and about the book, you indicated that in 1972, when this book was published, things in California were not as they are today, and perhaps Rudy Acuna wasn't as he is today either. What do you mean?
Oh, well, this was a moment of profound social change in California and the rest of the United States. Obviously, we had just we're living through the Vietnam War and all the student-based activism of those days, and it was a time in which people were becoming aware of who they were. I mean, this was a time in which American history in general was being revised, was being looked at anew by a new generation of scholars. And I think that the scholarship that's taken place then, a lot of it inspired by Rudy Acuna's book, has sought to say, well, you know, Latinos are part of the American story. What have they done? What have they gone through? What contributions have they made? What is unique about their experience that's, you know, as part of this American quilt? And so a lot of that work was just being done initially in the early 1970s. And, you know, you have to, I think, to get started on that really epic undertaking of telling the people's story. You have to begin from a posture of the urgency of it and the anger that leads you to do that, the anger of being ignored in American history, generally speaking. And so I think, you know, that was part of the mood of the times. Now, obviously, it's now 40 years on. And we can look back a little bit with more objectivity and maybe perhaps a little bit more, a little bit less intensity than back then.
Professor Acuna, when you wrote Occupied America, A History of Chicanos, were you angry? Did you use language that might have suggested to other people that you were and that resentment might be the right reaction?
No, I don't think that that the language was angry. I do think that it was very precise, and it did take on certain issues. Remember, Ruben Salazar had just gotten killed in East Los Angeles, and you had an awful lot of incidents where the Mexican community was being put down, and it mentioned those incidents. Remember, though, Occupied America is seven editions. It's changed an awful lot from 1972 to 2010. Also, Chicano Studies is not just history. It involves literature. We have classes in journalism. We have classes in multiple subjects, political science, etc. It is a pedagogy. Remember that in 1968, we had less than 100 PhDs of Mexican extraction in the country. Remember that the dropout rate was about 80%. Now, when we devised Chicano Studies, it was a form of a method, a pedagogy, to attack those dropout rates. And in fact, at La Raza Studies in Tucson, the dropout rate is less than 5% with the students taking the classes. The college, transferring to college, is 80%. So it's a way to motivate students, to study. Yeah, the things were bad in the past, but we can make things better.
And seven editions, that means it's being taught in a lot of places. Do you believe that the studies program in Tucson is taught in approximately the same way as is in other places, or is there something special about it?
Well, you know that actually, you know, just excerpts of Occupied America are used. It's not really used because it's above the level of high school students. It has an awful lot of books that it uses. For example, it teaches about magical realism in Latin America, you know, with García Márquez, and it teaches about poetry. It teaches about many subjects. It's not just history.
Roberto Sudo is a former director of the nonpartisan research organization, the Pew Hispanic Center. He's now professor of journalism and public policy at USC. Professor, good to have you back on our program.
Good to be with you.
What's your take on this controversy in Tucson and in Arizona generally?
Well, you know, the way we teach our history often reflects the way we think of ourselves. And I think this controversy is one manifestation of the kind of tensions that we see in Arizona and other places over a variety of issues, in particular the cultural change that's taking place in the United States through demographic change, largely as a result of immigration, and that's generated anxiety, which manifests itself in things like this in this law.
What's the reaction, do you think, or what's likely to be the reaction? And I should say, incidentally, that the Tucson Public Schools are contesting the making illegal of Chicano studies, Mexican-American studies in that state.
What's going to be the reaction?
Yeah, what's the impact when you do something like this? African-American studies are doing fine in Arizona.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to clearly increase some of the polarization that already exists there. It's certainly going to make a lot of Latinos feel that more defensive than they are already. It could, ironically lead to a stronger sense of group identity. That certainly has been the case in other places and other times when people feel defensive. They tend to look to each other, and in Arizona, this adds to what is already a tense situation for a lot of Latinos.
Do you agree that it's become a partisan issue in Arizona, or is it broader than that?
I mean, I think that to a certain extent, the larger question of that state's future is partisan. Although there are a number of Democrats who have come. Who are also have taken part in this law and the immigration law and as well, but it certainly has been politicized for sure.
What's the state of Latino political power in Arizona? As I know, Pew Hispanic Center does research on the demographics as compared to what it was, let us say, in 1972.
Well, I mean, it's a huge, a much, much larger electorate all over the country than it was in 1972. This population's grown enormously since then. And in Arizona, you've got whole generations of political representation that didn't exist then. So there's a congressman, there are other elected officials. I wouldn't say that there's as strong and as ingrained a political establishment there, a Latino political establishment, for example, in California, where we're now into the second and third generations of very well-established political figures. That's not the case in Arizona. It's a much fresher phenomenon.
Professor Acuna, if you were writing the history of this period, what lesson would you take from what's happened with your book in Arizona?
Well, I think, I've been to Arizona now 5 times since May. I've been walking precincts. I've been I've been at conferences there. And my conclusion is that it is a partisan issue. When you have money from the Chamber of Commerce, when you have money pouring in from the Koch brothers, I do think that it is a partisan issue. And when you have a division between the two parties, and I do think that there is, I think that it is a partisan issue. And I do think that it's getting dangerous. That's the first state in a long time, in about 30 years, that I've been called a greaser. And that's one of the things is that hate politics pays dividends. And that's the big thing. On Occupied America, people have not even read the book, and they are attacking it. What they are reacting to is the title, Occupied America. However, the title does not refer to the United States. It refers to the occupation of all of the Americas, and I make that clear in it. And also, I make it clear that people in the United States are not the only Americans, that the Chileans, the Argentines, the Peruvians, the Central Americans, the Mexicans are also American. And the way that we use that term many times becomes chauvinistic.
Well, thank you very much. That's all the time we have. Professor Rudy Acuna at Cal State Northridge. Good to have you back on our program. Roberto Suro, formerly with the Pew Hispanic Center, now at USC. Hector Tobar, columnist at the Los Angeles Times. And have a good holiday, all of you. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'll be right back with Which Way LA.
For more information about Which Way LA or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/whichwayLA. CD copies are also available. Call 1-800-600-KCRW.
Warman Only back with Which Way LA. Computers are only about 50 years old, but that's old enough to give them a museum. Where else but in Silicon Valley? Actually, the effort began 30 years ago on the other high-tech corridor, Route 128, around Boston. But the permanent opening of the Computer History Museum was last Thursday in Mountain View, north of San Jose. And Scott Ard is editor-in-chief of CNET, a technology website. He went down there. Scott Ard, good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
One of the things that's interesting about this is that I understand that the first exhibition is not entitled to computers 50 years ago. It's entitled Revolution, the First 2,000 Years of Computing.
Yeah, it actually dates back to some of the early thinking, you know, the use of the abacus and so forth, anything that was sort of mechanical that would help man, you know, calculate big numbers or to expand their thinking. So that's kind of some of the first things you see when you walk in is some ancient abacuses and then some video they have rolling to explain to you the concepts of using it, because these days I don't think there's too many people left that have actually used one.
So is the difference then, or is the point that there isn't all that much difference between the way the abacus worked and the basic way, the very basics of computers?
Yeah, I mean, just crunching numbers, trying to expand, you know, man's use of numbers and expanding the thought process. You know, they have another early computer there that dates from about the 1840s, and it was only a concept at the time called the Babbage Difference Machine. And he conceived this huge, massive machine that would just basically be used to crunch numbers to be used for ship captains navigating the seas, because they were notoriously inaccurate at the time. And now the concept was never proven until, you know, whether the machine would work until the 1990s, when they actually set about to actually create the machine. And it does work, and they have it there, and it's fabulous.
What about the objects that are there from the early days of what we think as computers 50 years ago or so?
Yeah, so the new exhibit is sort of laid out chronologically. And so early on, you'll see some of the computers that were designed in the 1940s, 1950s. Obviously, there was a very heavy military influence. A lot of them were created for military applications. For example, guiding missiles or crunching trajectories on ballistics and so forth. And so what strikes you is just the mammoth size of these things. You know, these machines were, you know, bigger than refrigerators, for example, but yet really only contained, you know, a fraction of the power that you have in your phone today. And then they have massive disk drives that, you know, each platter is about the size of a garbage can lid, and they could only hold, you know, maybe a book's worth of information at the time. So that's, you know, amazing when you first walk in and just realize that in 50, 60 years, how much advancements have been made.
Now, you've got a Kindle that can hold tens of books. I don't know about how many, if it's hundreds or not, but it's an awful lot.
There you go. Yeah, exactly.
What about, as I understand, the original Apple computer is there?
Yeah, they have an Apple One, it's referred to as, and it's basically just a board. It was sold basically to hobbyists and so forth around 1976. And so you had to kind of build the case for it yourself and add a keyboard and those sorts of things that came along eventually with the Apple II. But, yeah, they do have one of those there, and it's autographed by Steve Wozniak, obviously one of the co-founders of Apple.
As I understand it, too, you make the point that the PlayStations that we have now are more sophisticated than what was used to put a man on the moon. And I take it that's demonstrated at the museum.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, they had a bunch of pioneers from those days out at the museum about a week ago to meet the press and kind of walk through the museum and show their influences and so forth. And all of them remarked at how, as I mentioned, the military was a huge driver of technology, and, you know, post-war, even during the war. Even through the Cold War, and now you really have gaming that's really driving the technologies. What you have with, say, the PlayStation 3 is a really powerful machine, and what you have in the Xbox 360, you've seen recently where they're connecting the Kinect to it and doing really advanced input through just your body motions. So that was kind of interesting to hear the pioneers' seize on that it's nice to see that the military isn't driving all these applications. Now it's really the consumer, and specifically the gamer.
How about the way that people first used personal computers, for example, and how was advertising involved?
Well, they have an interesting display there. If you go back to, say, what was going on in the early 80s, where you had sort of Apple out there pushing the Apple IIs and even the Mac and the Lisa and the graphical interface, and then you had IBM kind of coming along and Microsoft, and they were really pushing what was going on in the workplace. So they have these juxtaposed video ads in which the Apple ad is very much reminiscent of what you would see now, kind of, you know, enlightened music, families around the computer. It was really geared towards, you know, accessibility and expanding your kids' you know, mind through educational software and so forth. Apple was huge in the schools at that time. And then right next to it, you have kind of the dowdy, you know, IBM PC Junior
and an ad that really touted the spreadsheets and more of the enterprise productivity side of the equation. And that's still kind of true today if you think about those two companies.
User friendliness on the part of Apple. What about the importance of the mouse?
Yeah, well, the mouse was, you know, I can remember going to the store, to computer stores in, say, the mid-'80s, and the Mac came out, and you had the mouse attached to it, and you could walk up to it, and without a whole lot of training, you could draw your name or draw a star or draw some kind of shape, and then press print, and out it came. So being able to get that image onto the screen that easily and then have it printed out, you know, almost precisely the way you drew it was, you know, light years ahead of what was going on right next door with the IBM PCs. Every time you had to get graphics into the machine, you were basically writing a program to do that.
Okay, computers have their own museum, the Computer History Museum in Mountain View, and Scott Ard with CNET. Thanks a lot for telling us about it.
Thank you.
Check out our Which Way LA Facebook page. In a moment, the U.S. and China face-to-face at the White House on Which Way LA. Norman Olney back with Which Way LA. President Obama and Chinese President Hu Jintao will first have a small private dinner with top aides. On Wednesday, they will attend the third full state dinner of President Obama's term. That's an honor that Hu Jintao was denied by George W. Bush. Mark Landler is diplomatic correspondent for The New York Times. Good to have you on our program.
It's nice to be here, Warren.
Compare the situation now with what it was like when President Bush was in office. And does this represent an important moment in the relations between the two countries?
Well, for the Chinese, the difference between a state visit that included only a lunch and a visit that includes a full state dinner, as President Hu is getting this time, that means a great deal to the Chinese. They are extremely driven by protocol. The interesting thing is that the underlying relationship isn't necessarily any better now than it was during the Bush years, and indeed one could argue it's even somewhat more tense. It's been a sort of a difficult stretch in U.S.-China relations over a variety of issues, both economic and political and strategic, and I think the Obama administration wants to use this moment to really shore things up, and if giving Hu the full trumpet and flourishes of a state visit is a way to do that, then they're happy to take that step.
Recently, just last week, Hillary Clinton, after the visit to China by the Defense Secretary Gates and after a economic speech by the Secretary of the Treasury, here is what Hillary Clinton had to say, summing up the situation.
Some in the region and some here at home see China's growth as a threat that will lead either to Cold War-style conflict or American decline. And some in China worry that the United States is bent on containing China's rise and constraining China's growth, a view that is stoking a new streak of assertive Chinese nationalism. We reject those views.
Mark Lander, back to you with the New York Times. To what extent are there people in the United States that want to contain China's rise, that are, in fact, worried about its growth?
Well, I think you'd have to say that on Capitol Hill, there are certainly some constituencies for that view. You know, it's primarily driven by economic insecurity on Capitol Hill, a fear that an undervalued Chinese currency continues to give China an unfair advantage over the United States, constrains U.S. exports, and in effect deprives the U.S. of some job creation. There are also folks on the strategic side who worry that the Chinese military is staking out an increasingly aggressive and independent position, in some cases perhaps even independent of the country's political leadership. So there are definitely people in the U.S. who fear China, both from an economic point of view and a military strategic point of view.
What about those who say that we better get along with China because they are a place where our exports can go? We, of course, profit from the fact that they own so much of American debt.
Well, that's the administration's point of view very clearly. And, you know, you played that excerpt from Hillary Clinton, which was a very interesting one. It happens to be one I quoted in my article on Friday.
That's why I played it.
She also took pains to say later in the speech that the U.S. and China need to find common areas of interest on issues like climate change, international financial architecture, and that the two countries should really put the emphasis on places where they can work together. And interestingly, that echoed almost exactly language that President Hu Jintao used in an interview he gave to the Wall Street Journal and the Washington Post, which was carried by those papers today, in which he too said, we need to find places we can work together, while also acknowledging, as Hillary Clinton did, that there are differences, there are strains in the relationship. So there does seem to be this effort to find common ground insofar as it's possible.
Interesting. He said in that interview that we should abandon the zero-sum Cold War mentality, view each other's development in an objective and sensible way, respect each other's choice of development, and also indicated we should respect each other's sovereignty. Those are fairly big issues.
They are indeed. And he also, you could read some of that as a bit of a rebuke of things that the administration has done in the last 6 or 8 months. One that comes to mind is when Hillary Clinton was in Asia last summer, she made a point of saying the U.S. was going to play a role in a dispute between China and its neighbors over islands in the South China Sea. And the Chinese reacted in a very angry fashion to this and said, this is an internal issue. These are our core interests that you're talking about, and we don't really want the U.S. to interfere. So I think what President Hu was also saying in that answer is that these two countries can best get along if they don't interfere in certain key areas, and that's one that he was clearly alluding to.
Meantime, you talked about the importance of a protocol, and at this state dinner, the first for President Hu, there's already articles being written about, will there be a celebrity chef? Will Michelle Obama's gown have an oriental flair? Obamas try to turn Hu onto American pop culture with their choice of entertainment? I'm reading from a piece by the Associated Press. How important are these kinds of things?
Well, they're very important. I mean, if you remember, the Obama administration made a huge show of giving the first state dinner of President Obama's tenure to the Prime Minister of India, and then the dinner was entirely overtaken by these party crashers, if you remember the couple that walked in without an invitation. So the way this event comes off, the way it looks, the atmospherics of it, will be vitally important, and particularly from the Chinese side. For the Chinese, the way a foreign leader is greeted in Washington has, enormous importance for the stature and prestige of that leader back home. And in this case, perhaps even more so, Hu Jintao is sort of in his lame duck phase as president. It's pretty clear he's now sort of anointed a successor. And there have also been these questions raised, most recently by our newspaper today, about whether President Hu enjoys the kind of unquestioned authority that Chinese leaders have in the past. And this comes up in the context of some of what the Chinese military's been doing and the way it's been asserting itself. So for President Hu to come to Washington and be given the full treatment will also help him perhaps answer some of those criticisms of what his stature is at home.
Well, Mark Lander, thanks as much always for being on our program.
Thank you, Warren.
Diplomatic correspondent for the New York Times. Adam Minter is in Shanghai. He writes for Foreign Policy and the Atlantic Magazine, among many other publications. He blogs at ShanghaiScrap.com. Adam Minter, early in the morning in China, thanks a lot for being on our program.
Well, it's a pleasure, Warren.
Tell us a bit about the way this is seen in China, particularly, again, with the incident with the party crashers. That reminds the people of other state dinners involving Chinese leaders where they were introduced with the wrong name of the country and other such things. How important is that to the Chinese?
It's critical. In fact, it's the most important side of this entire state visit. You have to sort of put this in a Chinese context, and that context is how Chinese people do their own politics. When you have a large party meeting in China, say some of the ones we had last year in Beijing, the people actually get to know very little. So what they do is they spend their time sort of parsing photos. Who is standing next to who? I mean, right now, quite literally, who was mentioned in what speech, who was not mentioned in what speech. And based upon this, they're able to sort of judge who's rising and falling, whose issues are rising and falling, what priorities are rising and falling sort of within their government. It's a party game, but it's also how Chinese people understand their politics. So you take this kind of way of looking at politics and you move it over to a state visit, and you've got all the elements to create this sort of great speculative bash from the Chinese side. Now, in 2006, as a New York Times correspondent just indicated, I mean, you had a number of situations that were sort of perceived as a snub in China. Number one, Hu was quite overtly given a state lunch instead of a state dinner. Now, even as Americans, we know that's not right. But from the Chinese context, and in the way that you treat a guest in China, that was considered, you know, a sure sign of disrespect. And then we had two other incidents during that state visit, which in the U.S., the Bush administration called them accidents. But in the Chinese side, where within sort of statecraft and official events, there are no accidents. They were considered, you know, signs of extreme disrespect. The first one was the playing of the Taiwanese national anthem when Hu Jintao came onto the White House lawn. Now, there's no issue more important in Chinese-U.S. relations from the Chinese side than Taiwan sovereignty. And so to play the Taiwanese national anthem was catastrophic from Hu's point of view as a national leader looking for national respect from the United States. And the second thing that happened was you had a protester from the religious movement, Falun Gong, basically burst out in a tirade on the White House lawn. Now, the White House made all kinds of excuses about how she got there, and more likely than not, the White House was telling the truth on this. But from the Chinese side, it was considered impossible that you could have a protester get onto the White House lawn and basically take away Hu's face during a state visit. And you brought up the party crashers. Actually, the party crashers, it was a funny story in the U.S., but from here on the Chinese side, it was covered quite intently. It was seen as a sign of disrespect to President Obama. Again, they looked at it through this lens of everything should be perfect at a state event, and you judge the leaders by what's going on around them. So that was viewed here really as a sign that perhaps Obama's power was in decline. So from the state dinner and the protocol side of these things, that's the most important thing from the Chinese perspective.
Mark Lander of the New York Times mentioned the recent assertiveness of the military. One example of that was when Gates was visiting, Secretary of Defense of the United States. There allegedly was, or not allegedly, there was a testing of a stealth fighter in China, which President Hu said then that he didn't know about. What was going on there? And did he really not know that the military was going to do that at the time when the Secretary of Defense was visiting?
Well, you know, we don't know. You know, certainly it's possible that the military, which has a lot of independence and some argue some growing independence in China, you know, that it did this without his knowledge. On the other hand, Hu is the head of the Central Military Commission? So there's no way to say for sure whether, you know, Hu Jintao is unable to exercise power over his military. You know, another theory is that, you know, the Chinese bureaucracy is an incredible mess, and it does things, it overlaps, you know, all the time, its own decision. So it may very well been a diplomatic or a bureaucratic snafu that causes. So we can't say for sure. But one thing is that within the Chinese internet, amongst the netizens, and you have to remember that China has the largest internet community in the world, there were sort of two reactions. One was sort of a triumphalist, this is a slap at the United States reaction. And the second one was that this is a waste and we can't really trust our government to be spending money on this kind of thing when we have hyperinflation in some parts of the country and political instability and corruption in others. So I mean, it's very difficult to say what was actually going on, but the reaction within China is you know, was pretty stark.
How well is Hu regarded by the Chinese? He is, again, pointed out by Mark Lander, a lame duck scheduled to be replaced next year.
Yeah, I take issue with the lame duck depiction of him. I think that's kind of an American way of looking at our leaders, that when we're elected as an American when American politicians are elected, they're elected with a lot of political capital, and you spend that capital. The modern Chinese leader, and by modern I'm saying really perhaps starting with Jiang Zemin, a leader who is not a revolutionary leader. So Mao Zedong and Deng Xiaoping were revolutionary leaders. Jiang Zemin, and to a much lesser extent, Hu Jintao were not. So when they became the head of the three branches of sort of Chinese power, they came in with less power than they have now, because the way you get power in China is through your relationships. You build your relationships. You do things for people. You have dinner with them. You make friends. And as you make friends, over the course of your time as a leader, your power increases. And so there's a very good argument within the Chinese tradition of power that Hu Jintao is actually more powerful now because he has better relations with the Chinese military than he did when he first came on board. People forget, at least in the U.S., those who follow this, is that when Hu was first elected by the Politburo to be China's leader, he wasn't the head of the Central Military Commission. That was something that was given to him by the prior leader, Jiang Zemin, only after a period into his tenure. And it was quite a controversy at the time within China whether Hu would be the head of the military or not. And there was actually a very famous case of a New York Times reporter being jailed because they had actually reported on a leak on that very matter in advance of it happening. So, you know, Hu personally is quite likely more powerful now than he was before. I think we get the idea that he's not as powerful because China has entered this stage of political sort of uncertainty and that there's going to be a tremendous leadership shift, the first in 10 years, in 2012. Now, we know who the likely successor is to Hu Jintao, and we know who the likely successor is to the premier, but it's all the jockeying beneath them. Who's going to sit on the Politburo? Who's going to get promoted to this or that post, to this party secretary of this city or that city? Because those promotions set up people for 2017 and 2022.
Okay.
And this is a party function, yeah.
All right. Margaret Pearson is professor of government and politics at the University of Maryland. And, Professor, good to have you on our program.
Nice to be here.
Tell us about the economic issues that are high on the list of the president of the United States right now.
Well, the economic issues for President Obama are ones that have been around for a number of years with China. The one that gets the most press is, of course, the question of the valuation of the Chinese currency. Is the renminbi valued too low, such that it helps Chinese exports much more than it should? So there are currency issues. There are a number of other issues that are also on the agenda as well, and those have to do with how much China is continuing to move toward being more of a purely market economy as opposed to having substantial state intervention. And a couple of those issues have to do with how much the Chinese government is supporting protection of intellectual property, and particularly the intellectual property of foreign companies. And then the second one is how much is the Chinese government, I guess we could say, discriminating against foreign technology in the sense that it is giving a leg up to what they call indigenous innovation, to technology that is supposedly produced inside China? Are they favoring that in government procurement contracts and so forth, so not having a level playing field in terms of the technology that's used? And just as a background to that, you know, technology and the level of technology that is able to be produced in China indigenously is still a big problem for them. So these questions of whether the Chinese government is supporting too much in contrast to using market forces for technology are very, very important.
Back to that question, during that interview with the Washington Post and the Wall Street Journal, President Hu said that people's democracy is the life of socialism. How do you interpret that as a China watcher, Margaret Pearson?
Sure. Well, the term democracy as it is used in China is certainly not meant in the same way that it is used here. And going back to the Chinese Revolution and Mao Zedong, they talked a lot about what democracy is and people's democracy, but it certainly is not a system where the idea is that the government is fully accountable to the people and can indeed be tossed out by the people. But what he really means is that the government is responsible for doing well by the people, for providing a growing economy that allows all boats to rise, and for providing a good set of policies that allows people to live better than they did in the past. That's sort of the essence of of people's democracy or socialist democracy. So the word democracy, we have to be very, very careful when we think about it as the Chinese use it. They're not insincere in their use of the term, but it just means something completely different.
Would it be used to justify what we would regard as the theft of international intellectual property and what you described earlier as discrimination against foreign technology?
Sure. Think so. There was a time, and this harkens back to ancient China, when you know the idea that if a technology was produced or some kind of innovation was made in society, it should belong to the people, and that obviously is very consistent with socialism. But you know, through the 1980s and 90s, and particularly in the context of China's WTO succession, the government sort of formally turned the page and said, no, we understand that private intellectual property and the rewarding of private intellectual property is very, very important to do. So there is a disconnect between what the official policy is, which would seem supportive of intellectual property as we understand it, and actually what they're able to carry out on the ground.
Whatever the individual issues may be, aren't the economies, the two of them, complementary?
Very complementary. And this is something, just picking up on what Mark Landler was saying earlier, you know, there's a disconnect between, I think, the perception in both the United States and in China about the relationship between the economies, a perception that if the other wins, we lose, zero sum, and the reality, which is of great complementarity of the economies. Not that there are not tensions, but that basically over the last period of time, the two economies have really benefited from what the others have provided. So, yes, I think complementarity is absolutely crucial. And the funny thing is that it's not really perceived that way, at least popularly in either country.
Okay. Margaret Pearson, again, professor of government and politics at the University of Maryland. The Chinese military, of course, is growing. Here's what Hillary Clinton, the Secretary of State, had to say about that.
I would be the first to admit that distrust lingers on both sides. The United States and the international community have watched China's efforts to modernize and expand its military, and we have sought clarity as to its intentions. As Secretary Gates stressed in Beijing this week, both sides would benefit from sustained and substantive military-to-military engagement that increases transparency.
Michael Swain is a specialist on China security issues. He formerly was with RAND, now senior associate in the Asia program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Welcome to our program.
Thank you, Warren.
What about the distrust? What about this clarity that the U.S. is looking for? Will this, do you think, lead to sustained and substantive military-to-military engagement?
Well, I think there's definitely an issue here in the military-to-military relationship that the two sides have a growing amount of distrust in many areas about the purpose of China's military development for the United States. Exactly where is it going? What are the long-term strategic intentions of the Chinese, and how do they relate to the force modernization that they're doing in a variety of areas? Much of this we know. We've seen historically they've developed their military for reasons of obsolescence, to overcome the obsolescence, and then to deal with what they regarded as a increasingly unstable situation regarding Taiwan. But in more recent years, they've also developed capabilities that could be used beyond Taiwan to try to strengthen their capacity to defend against uncertainties of various types beyond their borders, to show the flag, etc. And so the U.S. is interested in knowing, you know, how the Chinese think about this in greater detail and how they connect between certain force modernization changes that they've made and their doctrine. And so military-to-military relations becomes really important for the two sides to try to have this kind of a dialogue. And I should say from the Chinese perspective as well, there is deep concern in some parts of the Chinese military and other parts of the Chinese system that as China rises and becomes more influential in a variety of areas, not just militarily, that the United States will seek to try to counterbalance this, constrain this, or otherwise push back in areas that the Chinese might regard as important, and they want to preserve or they want to reduce their vulnerabilities to that kind of possibility without, however, really destabilizing the relationship with the United States. So it's a delicate kind of a balance that is going on here with both sides engaged in these concerns and suspicions, but both sides also needing to have greater understanding and greater contact. And I think that's what we've seen now. The civilian leadership on both sides have, I think, played a critical role in getting the two militaries to reengage and try to build a longer-lasting relationship that's more durable, that's less prone to disruption and termination because of political disputes of one sort or another, that can really have a chance of improving understanding about long-term thinking and reducing the chances of miscalculation over various crises of one sort or another, Taiwan and others, particularly as China's military capabilities increase.
Doesn't the U.S., though, have an enormous amount more military capability than China does?
Oh, there's no question about it. Overall, the United States has vastly greater capability than China militarily. I mean, people who make arguments about the U.S.-China relationship on the verge of some titanic shift in global power because of China's emergence and acquisition of military capabilities are just completely misstating the issue. The focus of the issue in the near and medium term and longer is the Western Pacific. It's the Asia-Pacific area. It's the ability of China to be able to deploy capabilities into the Western Pacific along the Asian littoral that could have an impact on American ability to operate in that area. American ability to reassure its allies and friends that it's still a major player, indeed a predominant player in that part of the world, the ability to manage crises more effectively, the ability to avoid arms races, etc. It's about that kind of an issue. It's about Japanese sense of security in the face of a greater Chinese ability to operate in waters around Japan. It's about the long-term fate of Taiwan and whether or not China at some point might be more inclined to be able to use coercive means to influence that through its greater military capability and how it would look at the United States in that kind of situation. It's about countries in the South China Sea and the disputes that they have with China and one another and how those might be influenced by a growing Chinese capability. That's the nature of the real issue here in China's military modernization, certainly over the foreseeable future.
All right. A primer on the upcoming summit meeting in the White House. There will be, once again, a private dinner, small dinner tomorrow night at the White House, and then the full state dinner on Wednesday. Thank you all for helping us all make better sense of all this. Adam Minter in Shanghai, blogging at shanghaiscrap.com. Margaret Pearson, professor of government and politics at the University of Maryland. Michael Swain at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And our earlier guest, Mark Lander, diplomatic correspondent for the New York Times. That was a rebroadcast of today's To the Point. Which Way L.A., produced tonight by Sonia Geis, Christian Bordahl, and Gary Scott. Managing producer, Cameron Redziner. Technical director, Wesley Roberts. Email us. Share your thoughts on our comment page, kcrw.com/whichwayla. Check us out on Facebook. I'm Armin Alney. Join us again for Which Way L.A. on 89.9 KCRW.
Which Way L.A. is made possible in part by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Nathan Cummings Foundation, the Rosalind and Arthur Gilbert Foundation, and the John Randolph Haynes and Dora Haynes Foundation, which supports study and research into policy issues of the Los Angeles region.